Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Drop and Go Parking. Offering easy and convenient parking, allowing you to hand over your keys and go directly to departures.
Welcome to Playback. Hang on to your hats, gentle listener. Yesterday afternoon, announcements coming hot and heavy. Take it away, Evelyn.
Media moving chairs is a great way to describe today, because the announcements have all been coming in a flurry this afternoon. So I suppose what we do know, of course, at this point is that David McCullough from this parish, as they say, is moving over to take over the Today programme, that kind of iconic flagship show on RT Radio 1. So that's the 10 to 12 show. That obviously means that Clare is moving on. So the RT announcement confirmed that Clare is departing. And then News Talk confirming just a few minutes ago that Clare is moving to join News Talk and she will take over. It says a mid-morning programme. We are assuming something around the Pat Kenny current slot that Pat has. Pat on air from 9 to 12. Now, this all started a little earlier. The detectives have been hard at work all morning because earlier this morning, on air as such, Pat had announced that he was moving on to the weekends. He said at springtime he would be moving from The Daily Show. So that was the first little clue that there was kind of movements afoot, because immediately people are thinking, right, who's going in that chair? And then obviously all this unfolded that Dave McCullough was going to be taking over the Today programme on Radio 1, leaving behind obviously the 6-1 and the Behind the Story podcasts, and for the moment anyway, and then that Clare was moving on to News Talk. So a lot of speculation. I think there's going to be a lot of commentary on this. And I mean, let's talk about Clare Byrne for 1 minute. Clare has been in RTE since 2010. She came from News Talk. So this is a return for Clare to News Talk. And she's been at the helm of that show since Seán O'Rourke stepped away in 2020. Now, there's going to be much commentary about this. You know, obviously, Clare, there can be any personal reasons why Clare wants to move. But, you know, watch out for this. There will be commentary around the salary cap. We know that RTE has a salary cap in place. There is a rule, a line or whatever, that nobody can earn more than the DG. His salary is capped at €250,000. We know from the RT annual report in 2023 that Clare Byrne's salary was at €280,000. It is not really a magical thing to think that maybe 5 years on there's some sort of contract negotiations happening. Is that one of the reasons she's leaving? We don't know, obviously, and that's her own personal business, but I'm expecting to see a lot of commentary around that factor in particular. Is that one of the reasons why Clare is moving on?
Ooh, arts and media correspondent Evelyn O'Rourke on the news at one. Deep breath, but don't touch that dial. And it's all change on a number of fronts.
The schools are back and a lot of you are back at work, and the summer holidays are fast becoming a memory, something in the rear view mirror. But still, you like the squeeze, don't you? The last bit of summer out of it. And then, just like the shark in Jaws, Mark Bow came up with the weather forecast. Now, the beginning, yes, brought us right back to May. Sunshine.
Those warm, sunny, humid days are pretty much gone now. And we're looking ahead to more unsettled, blustery weather, with our temperatures, of course, taking a slide as we wave goodbye to summer. After a bright and sunny start out there, a cold front is going to get flung across the country as the first sign of the more unsettled conditions ahead. You'll know it's on the way because the cloud will thicken and the winds will strengthen, and it's going to feel like change is in the air. Now, Tuesday is when we settle into the real change in the weather. Scattered showers and blustery winds will bathe the country with temperatures taking a hammering, struggling. Low pressure moves over on Thursday and Friday, putting the final nail in our meteorological summer. Have a good morning, everybody.
I love the fact that he says, have a good morning. I suppose, don't shoot the messenger.
Oh, well. But as the evenings draw in and we dig out the big cardigans, that presidential election gets ever closer. And this week, more twists and turns in the race. And for Fianna Fáil in particular, names being batted hither and yon. And if on a Tuesday you refuse to rule yourself out, by Friday, you're in and looking for the party's nomination. Yes, we're talking to you, Billy Kelleher, MEP.
Well, look, Claire, I have to be very honest with you. I mean, I haven't given this any personal thought myself. I mean, people did approach me some time ago, particularly some parliamentary colleagues, just saying, would I consider it? You know, lots of names were being discussed at the time in terms of MEPs across various political parties, and people did approach me at the time. But I didn't give it any personal consideration or political consideration, but I was more primarily focused on ensuring that Fianna Fáil would have a healthy, robust interrogation of candidates to ensure that we could find one that would stand scrutiny in terms of an election campaign, but also would stand for the values that Fianna Fáil exposes.
But
as well.
You're not saying you wouldn't do it.
Well, I mean, clearly, Claire, I mean, if a party approached a person and asked them, you know, obviously you would have to give it serious consideration. I've been a member of the parliamentary party since 1993. Mm. You know, I've given my life to the party and the party has been very good to me. But the point I'm making is if you were approached, well, obviously you would have to give it consideration.
Also on the line, not stirring the pot at all, Fionnán Sheehan of the Irish Independent.
What do you think of all that now?
You certainly didn't get a no from Billy there. I've known Billy 30 years. I've never heard him being so coy about something.
And Claire decided to take another run at it.
Billy, and the door is open. You're open to people phoning you perhaps after this interview and speaking to you about this. I take it.
Well, Claire, what I'm open to is ensuring that we have an open process within the parliamentary party. I mean, and that, you know, there is a mechanism in place where people can put their name forward or they can be encouraged by TDs and senators who are members of the parliamentary party and MEPs put their name forward.
Okay.
Claire, being very honest, I mean, what's most important to me is that we have a candidate that the party can be very proud of, that they found themselves in terms of having robust scrutiny, and then that we can go out and campaign for a candidate that represents our values as a political party and our philosophy.
It may or may not be you, is what you're saying.
Well, look, we want somebody that's pro-European, pro-enterprise, as in, you know, supports the rule of law.
Yeah. It could be you. Is he gone? Oh, he's gone. That was fortunate. But look, as Fionnán said earlier, the best word to describe
wasn't it
a lucky one? Coy, I think Fionnán was the word you used, and I think you were right. We have to leave it there, but we'll be...
And lo, yesterday Billy Kelleher confirmed that he was indeed willing to do the party a solid and put his name forward. The other name being bandied about, that of former Dublin GAA manager Jim Gavin. Yesterday John Downing of the Indo gave this analysis.
Now, his problem though is Jim Gavin, who seems to be the favourite in the eyes of Micheál Martin. So what's going on?
Well, we can take a lot from the silence both of Jim Gavin and of the leadership. There is very definitely movement. All of this has generated movement. Fianna Fáil were supposed to meet in Cork on the 15th of September, just a couple of days before the Dáil comes back. There's now every sign that there will be a meeting early next week. So they're pulling that back by the guts of a fortnight and trying to deal with this. Jim Gavin certainly has been approached, is certainly considering it, and there are lots of advantages from the leadership point of view and from HQ in opting for Jim Gavin, assuming he does take the plunge.
On Thursday's Drive Time, though, Colm put this crucial question to Fianna Fáil Minister Dara Cailleary.
You're a Mayo man and a Dublin 5-in-a-row winning manager. Jim Gavin has been widely talked about as your party's choice for running for president. How do you feel about that?
We are very forgiving in Mayo. And, you know, I'm not aware when it comes to the presidential election, the Taoiseach has said that he will make announcements about the party's position next week. So I await that. I wait, what name may come out of it.
That's quite the positive noise. Would you canvass for him in Mayo in the hypothetical that he was the candidate? Would you hand out leaflets with Jim Gavin's face on them saying, he's our man?
When I know who or what our strategy is in relation to the presidential election, I would fully support it.
Mayo for Sam. But what of Sinn Féin? Still no clarity. And with Mary Lou MacDonald not ruling herself out and now chatter of Piers Doherty, which way might they go? On Morning Ireland, here's Ellen Coyne of the Irish Times.
If Sinn Féin runs a candidate, do they need to run a candidate that, if they don't win, gets them into double digits in terms of vote share?
Absolutely, because I suppose speaking to people in Sinn Féin throughout the summer, they're still smarting from their performance in previous presidential elections. And there's always an anxiety in Sinn Féin that if they don't do well, they can be hypersensitive to a media narrative building around that and people writing about how the fortunes of the entire party are faltering. There's a lot of respect for Rose Conway Walsh in the party. You know, she's described as a very formidable person, and there's a strong desire in Sinn Féin to run a woman after 14 years of a male Fine Gael president. But I suppose there's also a recognition that Sinn Féin maybe should have used the summer to have Rose going around the country, kind of introducing herself to people and building her national profile. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Piers Doherty. There's always an inherent risk in running somebody who's a very strong member of your front bench, because again, the objective in Sinn Féin would have been to have Piers in the Department of Finance again instead of in Áras an Uachtaráin. But as you saw, as Danny outlined there, sure, a week ago it seemed like Fianna Fáil had no known prospects, and things have changed. Now they have two very strong ones. So Sinn Féin is pretty relaxed about leaving its decision to as late as maybe an Ord Cuala meeting on the 20th of September.
Meanwhile, prospective independent candidates are on the canvas. And this week saw Nick Delahanty putting himself forward as an independent.
There is a real sense of things stepping up a gear now. The independents will be looking to the local authorities, to the county councils, to get nominations. The councils, they like to be relevant in this too.
They sure do. And Gareth Sheridan and Nick Delahanty are doing a lot of shoe leather political campaigning this week. I was actually with Nick Delahanty in a rain-soaked Roscommon town yesterday because he's trying to court councillors to try to get him onto the ticket. Gareth Sheridan is doing the same. They both feel that they're in a relatively strong position, having at least half a dozen proposers and seconders across councillors. Most of those would be independents. Obviously, their focus at the moment is trying to court the likes of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael councillors to not support them, but facilitate them by abstaining and allowing them to get onto the ticket to try to contest this. Both of the 35-year-old men are very candid that they are starting campaigns with the full knowledge that they could be completely over in as soon as 2 weeks if the shutters come down on the local councils and they don't facilitate a path for independents to get onto the ticket for the presidential
certainly
election.
Certainly watch this space, things stepping up a gear.
Oh, it's hotting up all right, but as the weekend's independent TD Catherine Connolly is still the only confirmed candidate in this race. But we've a long way to go.
Just one text on the presidency before we wrap today. One person says, everyone and anyone seems to be lining up for this three-legged race. That's the presidency, in case you're wondering. I think Dustin the Turkey could fly again, says John. Well, who knows? You know, who knows, John? We may be discussing that on the programme tomorrow. But that is
from Drive Time. But we are not finished with the Áras yet, because on Second Captains, they had a pretty big interview.
You're listening to a special episode of Second Captain Saturday. Eoghan Murph here in Áras an Uachtaráin with renowned underage handball player, President Michael D. Higgins. You've talked a bit about the sense of belonging that comes from sport and what it has meant to you. One of the big moments, one of the big sporting moments during your presidency was the Robbie Brady goal against Italy that got us through to the knockout
kit
rounds.
Man. Well, first of all, there was this huge shock at protocol where I was semi-levitated in the stand. But afterwards, when meeting the team, it was in fact when everyone's congratulating everyone, and the kit man suddenly said, there's the jersey. And that's that. And
sorry, you got Robbie Brady's jersey?
I'm not going to admit it.
But I've asked the question.
I'll say it was handed to me by the kit man.
But high-flying kit aside, might it be the handball that gets him points?
You were a better than decent handball player by all accounts.
No, I think that I'm not really. I had the most magnificently humiliating experience. I was drawn in the Gaelic competition half an hour, as you know, and I was drawn against Pat Kirby. Now there's a moment's reflection after hearing the draw and all the rest of it. And it was to be played out in the alley in Newmarket and Fergus.
Okay, I think I need to give some background on Pat Kirby here. Like, we're dealing with an utter legend of Irish handball. He won 15 national titles, 8 world titles. Like, he's Duxie Walsh for a previous generation. This guy was something else.
But I think history suggests I broke his service once. And as he went on later to world fame, and really, and he was a very disciplined, compact player. He hit the ball, he made a great connection with the ball, and he had the same thing. I remember him taking 21s in for Aero Oak and Innes as well.
Well, I don't want you to be too modest about your handball abilities, because when you were awarded the Freedom of Clare, Freedom of Ennis in 2013, the only person other than Muhammad Ali to get
it's
that honour.
To be on.
Classmates of yours at St. Fannin's described you as a feisty, combative sportsman whose technique in playing handball could be described as closed fist and overhand swipe.
Does that sound?
Yes, it was gloved. In fact, do you see, Peter, we were pre gloves.
Mm.
And if you want to get to the competition, I have a bit of arthritis now. I think that I had very good eye to hand coordination. That part of it helped me.
So are we saying breaking the serve of a future world handball champion is your highlight?
It's got to be.
No, it's my most humiliating half an hour in memory. But he's lovely. He was a good person. No, there were two in competition, I think, for each other. I did mention, you know, winning the cup. Galway United winning the cup. And that Johnny Glynn knocking the ball down for Tommy Keane.
1991.
Thank you, yes, indeed. So we must not exclude that.
Well, maybe we can have joint highlights today, Murphy.
Yeah, I'll listen. That might be fair enough. Rules and protocols are out the window.
And President Michael D. Higgins got a season-topping 90 points, putting him in the lead. But would the current president be drawn on his successor?
What would you like to see in Ireland's next president? What would you like their priorities to be?
Well, I can't possibly talk about the forthcoming events. All I know is that I'll do my best to have the place looking all right.
President Michael D. Higgins on Second Captains. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Another week, another new planet. This one is 430 light years away, and it's young, currently forming an atmosphere young. Joining Rachel, Dr. Christian Ginsky of UCG, part of the international team that found the planet.
So it's an enormous planet. Whereabouts did you find it? It's going around, I gather, something similar to our own sun.
Yes. So the young star that we have looked at, this is from a study led by the University of Leiden that we are working together with the PhD student Richelle van Capellewin. And we looked at this together. And this is a young star in the constellation of the Eagle. It's actually even visible in principle from Ireland. And it's one of those nearby stars that we think are young. And now we had a first look to see if there's maybe planet formation going on around it.
And is it almost inevitable then that if there is a star similar to our own sun, that planets will start to form around it?
That is actually what we are thinking right now. We have discovered thousands of extrasolar planets already, but very few that we actually have an image of, and even fewer that are so young as the one that we have discovered now. But yes, we think that planet formation is almost inevitable.
But never mind the science, Rachel thought that maybe they could work on getting a catchier name.
As things stand, this planet doesn't have a particularly snappy name. What are you calling it?
So WISPIT 2, the name comes from the survey program that is led at the University of Leiden. So that is the Wide Separation Planets in Time survey, where we were trying to figure out if these planets move around stars at different ages. So this is where the name comes from.
Will it be getting a better name than that, or is it destined to be WISPIT 2 for eternity?
Well, actually, the name that WISPIT 2 is probably better than the catalogue name, which is just a really long number, to be honest. So it's
okay, so it could be far worse than that.
But turns out they have form when it comes to the plane names.
Now, the telescope that you use, I presume it's very, very strong.
It's the largest telescope that we have available in the world right now for optical and near-infrared observations. That's the Very Large Telescope. That's actually the name of it in Chile.
So it's called the Very Large Telescope. It's as simple as that. Oh, I like that one. So what's next? Now that you've found this planet, and as you say, it's not yet fully formed, where does your work go from here?
Now we are trying to understand how the planet is interacting with its birth environment. So it's when your listeners see the image there, it's in these concentric disc rings is where it's nestled in. And we want to understand how it is interacting, how it's moving in the system, what dust properties are there, because that tells us what dust the planet probably formed from. And eventually what we want to do is we want to reobserve that system with even more powerful telescopes. Now we have the Very Large Telescope, and in about 5 years we will have the Extremely Large Telescope.
You're having me on.
No, it's we like The extremely large telescope is currently in construction in Chile. It's a 40-meter class telescope, so the main mirror is 40 meters wide. Will be the largest telescope on Earth. And the University of Galway has observing time coming up on this telescope once it goes online.
Oh, well, that's fantastic to hear. Listen, thanks once again.
From the News at One. And with Claire, a voice that triggers the nation, Dr. Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity. The plague is back. But he doesn't sound too worried.
The Black Death? Yeah, there's a case in Lake Tahoe. And they reckon it was a flea, because it's flea transmitted, as you may remember from school, you know, this awful Black Death. So a flea bit a tourist and they got very severe symptoms. Now, the good news is you can stop antibiotics kill it.
Right.
So it's not like it was in medieval times.
But still, it's a very serious disease to get, right?
The symptoms can be really severe, obviously enough, you know, and if it's untreated, it'll kill one in three people. Like millions of people died, as we remember, in the medieval times. Mm-hmm. But they're slightly concerned because they're wondering, is it going up? There's no evidence for that yet. But of course, the CDC in America, even though they're under attack by Trump, they're monitoring this and wondering. There have been a few cases over the last couple of years. So again, they're wondering what's going on there.
And is it particular to the fleas in Lake Tahoe?
It could be. Yeah, obviously it's gone into the flea population. They reckon, because the fleas live on rodents, again, as you remember, rats were the big cause in Europe.
God, it's probably squirrels.
I think it was squirrels. That's their theory. They went out and sampled and they found some of it in the fleas, infected fleas in squirrels. It's caused by a bacteria called Yersinia pestis, because pest means plague. You know, that's where mm-hmm. it's the cause of it.
So the plague is back. Lovely. And this week we also had the rise of the Asian hornet, a nest found in Cork. Here's John Kelly, Invasive Species Programme Manager at the National Biodiversity Data Centre.
How do you tag an Asian hornet?
Well, it's a technique that was actually developed in Jersey and also in Britain. So you are using essentially a little bit of reflective string, so silver tinsel is a good description. And then under license by MBWS, the tag is glued onto the Asian hornet. And then you're able to see the Asian hornet fly and then get a sense of the direction it's going. Mm-hmm.
But do you have to catch him to put the tinsel on him?
Yes, we do have to catch them first. And
that's extraordinary.
The team here have been doing amazing work. MPWS and also beekeepers have been supporting efforts in Cork City as well. But it's been a fantastic achievement to find this nest as fast as we have.
Is this an extermination?
Yes, this is an invasive species. There's no other known nests anywhere around Ireland. So at this moment in time, we believe there's only one nest. Our efforts to verify that will continue.
Ooh, fingers crossed. This week, in the early hours of Thursday morning, 598 drones and 31 missiles were fired into Ukraine, including attacks on the capital, Kyiv. At least 23 people, including 4 children, were killed. On Drive Time, Colm Mungon spoke to Ukrainian MP Oleksiy Goncharenko.
In looking at this, and I know your own president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has said that this shows Russia's true intent. It shows that they're not committed to diplomacy. Is this something you'd imagine will be raised with the United States and European countries to show that Ukraine needs additional supports, air defence and the like, in the short term until there is a realistic prospect for diplomacy?
Yes, definitely. And also the embassy of European Union was damaged during this attack, which is itself absolutely outrageous act. And I hope that now there will be more reaction from our allies, first of all, Europe and United States. And from United States, we're waiting to put a real pressure on Russia, because it doesn't look like when we hear from President Trump and his team, we're moving to peace and there is a great progress and all this stuff, but where is the progress? And especially it's painful. I mean, it's just Putin is killing civilians just deliberately. At the same time, he's handshake, he is red carpeted, he is absolutely welcome. And that is, I don't know, this is disgusting.
This was the second largest strike since the beginning of the war, and now a renewed focus on securing peace for Ukraine.
We will do our best to message United States, but the decision will be made by them. It is very important. I think it is very important now, the position of people, because fortunately, United States, as Ireland, as European countries, are democracies. And in democracy, the people's attitude is very important. And I think that we need to speak. And I want to thank you that you are covering the story. You're speaking about this, because after 3 years of full-scale invasion, people got used to this. Oh, yes, somebody else again killed in Ukraine. Okay, but this is not normal. We are in the middle of Europe, and in the 21st century, just a brutal killing of innocent people. So I think there should be pressure from societies and politicians to say, you need to stop this, because we are just human.
Ukrainian MP Oleksiy Goncharenko on Drive Time. And this week it was announced that the UNIFIL peacekeeping mission in the Lebanon will come to an end by 2027. Since 1978, more than 30,000 Irish troops have served at Camp Shamrock. And over those 47 years, 47 Defence Forces lives have been lost. On Morning Ireland, Áine spoke to Clotilde Bigo.
Remind us why the UNIFIL mission was set up and what it's been doing for nearly five decades.
Well, so the UNIFIL mission was set up during the Lebanese Civil War and in 1978, and then it became extremely important in 1982 when Israel occupied Beirut and then eventually kept on occupying the south of Lebanon until the year 2000. And basically what the UNIFIL mission did and is still doing is monitoring and keeping tabs on the different violations and the different issues that have been happening in southern Lebanon on what we call the blue line, which is basically the border between Lebanon and Israel. And basically, UNIFIL was said to be more or less efficient depending on the times. During the 2006 war between Lebanon and Israel, it was extremely important. And then its role became a bit less important throughout the years. But within the last war, it became more important again. And now we're seeing the same critiques saying that it has become more or less useless.
And while Israel has long opposed the presence of UNIFIL troops in the Lebanon, Áine put this to the Beirut-based journalist.
I'd be interested in hearing the reaction there in Beirut to this decision to wind down the UNIFIL mission. Just, I'll introduce you to what we heard about it in the papers, the prediction from one former Irish peacekeeper that the end of the mission will mean Hezbollah will kick off, the Israelis will retaliate, and with no peacekeepers, they'll annihilate everything in their path. It will be like Gaza. Is that what people in Lebanon fear?
Yes, more or less. What people in Lebanon fear is that without a buffer zone created by the UN, so the UNIFIL, Israel will be able to enter Lebanon as it wishes and then occupy. And of course, the fear that Hezbollah will also use this this zone to basically do what it wants against Israel without any buffer zone created by UNIFIL is also a very big fear. What UNIFIL does today is that it really creates kind of a buffer zone between Hezbollah and Israel, and it kind of tones everybody down in a way.
For Morning Ireland yesterday. Well, on Liveline, Cormac spoke to soldiers who had served in the Lebanon.
Johnny, good afternoon. You served 9 tours of duty, is that right?
About 16 tours altogether. I'd served 9 in Lebanon between the years of 1980 and 2000. In all, nearly 8 years service would have been spent coming and going to Lebanon.
Can I ask you, Johnny, about the actual day-to-day work of an Irish peacekeeper in the Lebanon?
Yeah, and a lot of people ask me this down through the years, like, why do you travel to Lebanon, such a far-off place and hostile place? But at home, young soldiers, they train, they get upskilled. In my case, I was communication, so it was signals. When I'm going back to 1980, it was laying telephone lines across wadis and maintaining those lines And, you know, you spend maybe 2 days walking waddies, meeting the locals while they're getting in their harvest. And we are known and seen and became part of the local community with our presence out there. And to a young soldier, at home you train, but when you go on a mission to overseas, it's like you get to run the race. It's that you've trained at home, but now you have to perform your talent, your skill, your expertise. And people rely on you, whether you're an engineer, you're a guy in transport, your signals. You don't go home at 4:30 like you do or 5 o'clock in the evening.
You're always
home. You're living with these people that you're providing a service for. And it's that satisfaction of doing your job and that you're getting the result for the community of people that you're with.
You served as well, Larry?
I did. I'd done 7 tours there, Cormac, between 1989 and 1999.
Okay. But in terms of your reaction to the fact that this could be wound down?
Well, I think it opens up another conflict, because Hezbollah will have free rein in South Lebanon, as will Israel. And we could be looking at another Gaza in the south of Lebanon. That's what I predict, that the Israelis will go in again, like they did in 1978, right up to the Tani River, which is 20 kilometres inland.
And they can't at the moment because of the peacekeeping mission, is that it?
They can't because the peacekeeping mission is in place, sir.
Kevin is also on the line. Good afternoon, Kevin. You served?
I did indeed. I had 3 tours of duty with UNIFIL and 2 tours of duty with UNSO, which is the other UN organisation in the area comprising of unarmed military observers.
You as a soldier, Kevin, over the years, you must have seen some attacks and vicious, violent behaviour over the years. In Lebanon.
I have, yeah, and I think I was there during a 7-day war in 1993. I was there during another 7-day war in 1996, and I was there as a military observer with my wife and young family in 2006. And we had a strength of 52 military observers, and in 3 days we lost over 10%. We had one Australian captain seriously wounded. She was eventually evacuated with my wife and kids. We had an Italian captain shot in the back. He's now in a wheelchair. And the Israelis fired a bunker-busting missile into a post of ours in Kian, killing 4 very good friends of mine. So, I've seen like most Irish veterans, we've all kind of had our own experiences in Lebanon.
And do you remember on days like this, Kevin, when it's in the news, do you remember those 4 friends that were killed?
I remember them. There's not a week would pass that I wouldn't remember them.
Just some of the voices on Thursday's Liveline. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now to news that almost broke the internet wide open. Your English teacher and your gym teacher are getting married.
It was announced on Instagram yesterday evening, our time. Gorgeous pictures to the soundtrack of So High School. Will you tell us about the meaning of that song?
Yeah, so that is one of Taylor's songs from her last album that came out last year, The Tortured Poets Department. It's kind of seen as a last minute addition to that album, because if anyone has listened to the album, it's quite dark and it's seen as a breakup album of her previous relationships. But that song was kind of seen as the song that she'd written about Travis once they'd gotten together. It really kind of builds into the fact that he's a football player. He's quite a successful football player in the States. He's not a nobody. So it kind of tied into that trope that Taylor's always played into about being the cheerleader and getting with the football captain. So it was quite an appropriate song for her to choose, because it is about Travis.
What do the Swifties make of Travis?
I think most of them are quite excited over it. I think particularly that they're a lot more public this time around. The Swifties do kind of like knowing what's going on, and they do really appreciate that. Travis is a fan as well of Taylor. He really kind of played up to that before he, like as you played the clip there, he went to the show 2 years ago as a fan. So I do think that they really like him and that they're quite excited for Taylor as well. She is very good at kind of keeping her fans feeling like they're part of her life. And I think that they're quite excited for it in general.
Ooh, Fascinators at Dawn, folks. This is going to be one big day out. Oh, and that was Daniel Mahoney of Missy.ie with Audrey. And of course, it wouldn't be Morning Ireland without something of a harder note.
I mean, without wanting to write it off before it even begins, but I can't imagine what it must be like to negotiate a prenup agreement.
Yeah, I mean, look, Taylor is at just such a huge level. And, you know, to say the same about Travis, he, you know, is quite successful as well. Like, if you see the rock that she's after getting, it's quite substantial. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'd imagine that that's going to take quite a while to negotiate that alone.
But they weren't the only cynics in the garden. The Darcy was joined by barrister Tim Bracken.
I mean, this is the awful thing about prenups, Ray, is that there's a happy couple just after becoming engaged. But, I mean, where's the romance?
Yes.
Where's the Mills and Boone element of it? You know what I mean? If a fella's down on one knee with the ring in one hand and the contract in the other, I mean, where is the romance in that?
Well, it does sort of put a lid on the romance. I'm just thinking, they're talking about the ring. It's an old mine, brilliant cut diamond, Tim, for your information.
Right.
And they're speculating that it's worth between $250,000 and $5 million. So what are the legals around an engagement ring?
Well, the whole idea of the engagement ring, you see, is because we always consider marriage and, well, we could say, until recent times, marriage was always regarded as a religious ceremony where a couple came together. And, you know, it was blessed by the church, etc. But, like, marriage is actually a legal contract. And therefore, and for a legal contract, you must have an offer, an acceptance, and you must have a consideration, the consideration being the money or money's worth. And the ring was always regarded as the consideration. So he gave her a ring, and that was in consideration of her marrying him. Mm. And therefore, that is part of the legal contract. So therefore, when they did get married, I would assume that the ring then becomes her property because the contract has been fulfilled. Uh-huh. But if the engagement, say, broke off, well, then I think he was entitled to the return of the ring because the marriage didn't complete.
Probably the least of his worries.
Oi, 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 let's let them get married first before we have them divorced and scrapping. Hopping back on board the love train now, courtesy of reporter Maura Fay.
It's really nice for her. I think all, I'm not personally a Swifty fan, but I think all the Swifty fans were going mad last night on Instagram, especially about the way she proposed and posted on Instagram, instead of the Paps getting to it first.
Do you think he did a good job of organising the proposal? Was it very romantic?
Yes, definitely. I'd say there was a lot of money spent on flowers. Happy for them. Good luck.
Do you think they'll have a successful marriage?
Hopefully. It'll be a lot less drama from both fandoms, I guess.
Do you think it'll affect her songwriting?
Maybe. A lot less breakup ones and a lot more happy ones, I guess.
I thought it was absolutely very good. I seen up on social media on the Dublin airport, and I went to Taylor Swift concert I think about a few years ago out in Croke Park, and I thought she was absolutely brilliant. She's fantastic.
Do you think they'll last?
Well, I don't know, but I'd say probably they will, but if they do, they do, they don't, they don't.
They look like a lovely couple, so it's nice to see a bit of love in the air. So congratulations to them both.
Any tips for them on a successful marriage?
Don't ask me, I'm divorced.
Banish that thought. And make no mistake, this is one hell of a merger. Here's Yasmin Rufo, culture reporter with the BBC. Posh and Bex in the Halfpenny Place.
This pairing redefines power couple, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. I think this is kind of the power couple right now. And, you know, it's interesting because both those people have such loyal fans in totally different areas of the media. So I think it's really interesting them sort of coming together and bringing their fan bases together almost. You know, we've seen Taylor support Travis at some of his games and vice versa. He's seen her on stage and she was on the podcast. So, you know, that relationship has been building slowly over time. And yeah, you're right. You know, when you look at the Instagram post, I think it's got more than 18 million likes now. The amount of celebrities commenting, you've got the Prince and Princess of Wales, William and Catherine liking the post, President Trump is wishing them luck. You know, you've got everyone from all walks of life actually really invested, engaged, and talking about an engagement, which is quite rare to see. You know, you don't see many, many other celebrity couples get engaged, and then you have sort of royalty and the president all commenting about their thoughts on it. And I think it's interesting because there's always been a fascination and interest with Taylor Swift's love life, her past relationships, her heartbreak. You know, famously, she writes about all of her exes in her songs. So fans for years have followed her romantic journey, and to see her sort of finally reach a point where she's met someone and she's happy and there isn't that heartbreak, at least not right now, it's really lovely for Swifties.
Well, let's hope the heartbreak isn't coming, and it's lovely to see them so happy, and they have.
Go on, the love. But scroll forward a few years, Tay-Tay and Travis, maybe a couple of kids. How to keep the love alive. Sophie White's new novel, Such a Good Couple, explores just such questions, minus, of course, the superstar status, 24-hour nannies and unlimited funds.
All your books start with this question, don't they? And
yeah.
Essentially, the question here, many years into a relationship, is...
why stay married when there's so many better options? So, I always pick a kind of an anchor question when I'm working on a novel, and I write it on a piece of paper, I put it above my desk, and I kind of check in with it as I write, thinking like, how is this plot kind of serving this central sort of existential question of the novel?
Yeah.
And my husband knows all about the question.
Yeah. He kind of gets the question out of you, does he,
Seb? He gets the question out of me. Seb is my husband.
And the question was, why stay married?
Yeah, we were in Bantry having a lovely meal together at the Literary Festival down there. And he was like, so like the new novel, how's it going? Like, what's this question for this novel? And I was like, it's just kind of that thing of like, why stay married when there's so many better options out there? And he was like, took it like a champ. He was just like, received it like a gut punch, said, oh, that's great. Not an indictment of our marriage at all. I said, of course not. Of course not. If I was worried, I'd never, ever write a book like this. So I think as well, something I was quite interested in is like, everyone in this book is kind of millennial. And a lot of millennials, you know, could have got with their other half in like analog times.
Yes, okay.
And
I get you,
now
yeah.
We're in the times of the apps. And a lot of these people have never gotten to experience the apps.
Yeah.
And I know there's like some kind of question of like, the apps seem like fun. I love online shopping. So, you know, this seems like something I could really enjoy. And you do have this kind of outstanding question of like, would we do a break?
Do your friends discuss these things? Are you kind of hearing all of these conversations going on, whirling around?
Yeah, totally.
And she talked about the day-to-dayness of bringing up those kids.
Having children and, you know, trying to maintain the kind of the fun of your relationship.
Yeah.
Like, it's definitely something that needs to be sort of, I don't know, actively worked at, because you can, I think, when you're in the trenches with like young kids, you can go like weeks without making full eye contact with your other half. It's just you're mainly communicating through the shared Google Calendar, and you know,
what's next?
Yeah.
Get through this week.
Where are you at 11 a.m. on Wednesday? Because I'm not at home, and we need childcare. And yeah, and like I do think it's like the funnest thing you'll ever do. You know, is you know have kids and like. You know, it does make you a team, but sometimes it makes you feel like you're running a kind of a small business together. You know, I think so.
And she might just have outed families all around the country with this.
The big bowl. So I wrote this big bowl thing in the book, practically just because I wanted to know, does every house have this?
Okay.
It's the big bowl that you use for popcorn and also for getting sick in.
Yes,
and
that's right.
I swear people have been texting me on DMs to be like, yes, the popcorn sick bowl is a real thing.
It's not called out of the shelf when you go to buy it.
Yeah.
Popcorn/vomit bowl.
I know. So I'm feeling like very validated that people are getting in touch and being like, yes, this is a real thing. You aren't the only scummer in the world.
Beautiful. Sophie White with Oliver. And staying on something of a theme, minus the puke, we turn to on-screen chemistry on Arena. Ricochet spoke to Paul Whittington and Serena Bellissimo about couples that sparkle and fizz and those that flop. But let's start with the sparkle.
Let's do James Cameron's Titanic.
Can we?
Jack and Rose, Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio. Start with their on-screen chemistry. What did you make of it when that film finally hit the big screens in all its big rumbly glory in 1997?
They were incredible on screen. I mean, down from literally steam coming off the screen when they were in that car and the window was fogging up. But the fun that they had, it was just the two of them were so perfectly matched. I know Leo had done a few films before that, but his star really was just on the rise. And I think, you know, the fact that they both came in at similar ages and they've navigated Hollywood and gone through the same similar career paths at the same time and been there for each other, I think because they were so powerful on screen, this is what happens with the on-screen chemistry as well. Because they're so powerful on screen, you actually want it to be true off screen. And they just look like the best of mates.
They got on and they definitely did. And they have remained in touch with each other, I think, yeah. So
the whole way through.
It does seem to help.
Oh, my heart will go on. And yet not enough for Rose to make room for Jack on that door in the ocean. But enough of the sparks. What about when it's flat, dull, excruciating?
Okay, we've done enough of the good. We're going to have to at least skirt over the absolutely appalling.
There's a few.
Serena, do you want to start with Dakota Johnson and Jamie Dornan in all of the 50 Shades films?
Yeah. Now, look, I never read any of
the... Poor old Jamie Dornan, he's a good actor as well.
And but so is Dakota Johnson.
Yes.
And I just feel like when they don't have it, they just didn't have it. And I don't know if it came down to them. I don't know if it came down to the direction.
The script
was appalling. And I know by the time... And I only watched these for work.
I only saw the first one. I somehow contrived to miss the...
I wish I never watched any of them because they're just terrible. And by the third, you knew that they had signed, again, people who had signed this before their careers had skyrocketed in a different direction. They're like, oh, we have to go back and make this. Yeah. And by the third, I felt like I could see the two of them going, we don't want to be here.
Yeah, they didn't work for some reason. But you never know if it's them or the script, because I think if the script is terrible, it can look like...
The script was atrocious.
Yeah.
And I think they knew that too.
Ooh, crushing when there just ain't no bubbles in your fizzy pop. And that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And this goes out to all those at the electric picnic. Punches at the ready to dance in a field.
Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Check it out now, the Funk Soul Brother. Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Check it out now, the Funk Soul Brother. Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Check it out now.